When it comes to self-improvement, there's no shortage of books, tips, websites, and online articles, particularly when it comes to boosting memory or brain power. The search term "hack your brain" turns up more than 7 million hits on Google. In this episode, we're talking about brain stimulation, using external devices involving magnetic fields and electricity to zap the brain. In recent years, a market of do-it-yourself devices has developed, promising products that can deliver a quote-unquote instant boost to memory or attention. But the safety of these devices is another question, as is whether they even work. Can these brain-stimulating devices actually make us think faster or remember better? To tell us more, we spoke to Dr. Martin Sale, a researcher at the University of Queensland, who leads clinical studies involving brain stimulation.
Brain stimulation is essentially a way that we can artificially, I suppose, affect brain activity. And so there are two main forms of brain stimulation. There's magnetic brain stimulation and electric brain stimulation. Both of them work, generally speaking, in the same way. What we're trying to do is to affect how the brain functions, and we can do that in short periods of time with single stimuli, or over longer periods of time. And when we apply many stimuli across a period of time, maybe 15 or 20 minutes, we can induce long-lasting changes in people's brain activity, which we refer to as neuroplasticity. And we know that neuroplasticity is really important in how the brain learns new skills and stores memories and also recovers function after brain injury like stroke. And so my research is really interested in trying to work out ways that we can harness this brain's ability to undertake neuroplastic change to improve brain function.
Martin, how safe is brain stimulation? I mean, it sounds quite extreme to apply electricity to the brain.
That's a really good question, Donna. And I guess the safety of these forms of brain stimulation is something that people are quite interested in. And there's been a lot of research done to try to understand how safe these things are. And I guess one thing that we don't know is, are these things safe over the longer period of time? What we do know is over short periods of time, when people come in for a single or a couple of sessions, there are very, very strict guidelines that affect how much, I guess, a dose of this brain stimulation that we can give people. And if we stick to those guidelines, then the brain stimulation is incredibly safe. We do induce changes in the brain, but they're short-lasting and people don't have any ongoing effects from it.
What kind of changes are you looking at specifically?
My research is focusing on a region of the brain called the motor cortex, which is involved in how people move or coordinating movements. What we're trying to do is to make some of those discrete parts of the motor cortex a little bit more excitable. People don't walk out of an experiment being able to walk faster or being able to play the piano better than they did beforehand. But what we think is that if we can boost some parts of activity in the motor cortex at the same time as people are getting rehab from a stroke, for example, or if they're learning a new task whilst they're receiving the brain stimulation, they seem to be able to perform those tasks better compared to if they just perform those tasks without the brain stimulation.
Can you talk us through the different types of non-invasive brain stimulation more specifically?
So we can broadly classify them into magnetic and electrical brain stimulation. And two of the forms are essentially to try to induce neuroplasticity. So we can apply electrical stimulation or magnetic stimulation repeatedly, and we can either increase or decrease the excitability of the brain depending on how we sort of tweak the parameters. So that's really nice that we can either make a part of the brain more or less excitable, because in some conditions, brain regions become hyperexcitable and brain stimulation can be used there to sort of dampen down its activity, whereas other conditions are associated with reductions in brain activity, for example, after a stroke. And so brain stimulation, either magnetic or electric, can be used to increase the activity of those regions.
So what does that look like? Because when you say magnetic or electric, I think the average person thinks, oh, is it like an MRI? Is it like, you know, electrodes to the brain like you would restart a heart? You know, what does it actually look like when someone comes in?
So magnetic brain stimulation, I suppose, is the larger of the two machines. But the actual bit that we stimulate with is a small coil about the size of a discus, I suppose. And that we put that on someone's head and we put it over the region of the brain that we're interested in stimulating. And then there's a large set of boxes that store the electric charge, and then we press a button and that is discharged under that coil that we've placed above the participant's head.
Does it hurt?
It doesn't hurt. It sometimes can be a little bit uncomfortable if we place it over regions of the brain that have got a bit of muscle underneath, because the stimulation activates those underlying muscles as well. But generally speaking, the scalp is free of muscles, and so it doesn't hurt. But certainly, I guess, if we turn the intensity up too high, it could become a little bit unpleasant. But that's, again, where we fit within the safety guidelines to make sure that we don't make it uncomfortable. Electrical brain stimulation, on the other hand, could be uncomfortable if you turned it up too high, and it would just feel like a sharp tapping sensation on the scalp. With electrical brain stimulation, we've simply got a large battery, I suppose, and it can be about the size of a toaster. And we just connect a couple of electrodes to the region of the brain that we're interested in. And again, we can adjust the stimulus parameters there to affect how we want the brain to respond.
But obviously you're working within safety parameters, so generally speaking, it's comfortable for participants.
Yeah, generally speaking, with electrical stimulation, participants can't even feel it. And as I said earlier, that's a really great thing from an experimental point of view, because participants are unaware whether they're receiving what we call active stimulation or sham stimulation, where essentially we don't turn the machine on, and participants can't generally tell the difference between the two.
So I guess that's good for research integrity then.
It's fantastic for that point of view, yeah.
Have you ever had brain stimulation yourself?
I've had brain stimulation more times than I care to remember. It got me through the later part of my university. I was a bit of a lab rat in brain stimulation labs, and I've had it all through my postdoctoral work as well.
There's a growing trend in people experimenting with DIY devices, so to speak, in their own homes. Do they work? Do you have concerns about this?
Look, I suppose, unfortunately, I'd have to say the way that electrical stimulation works is actually very easy to bring those machines into the home environment. It, as I said, it's basically just like a battery that you connect one, the anode and the cathode, to different regions of the brain. So participants or home users can find those devices on the internet very easily, and they're relatively cheap. So there is a lot of documentation in the press about people using them in the home environment. And I suppose my advice to people thinking about that would be to tread with a fair degree of caution. I've heard reports of parents acquiring these machines to give to their children to, I guess, ideally boost their performance for exams, to try to boost their ability to learn before exams. And I suppose in theory that sounds like a great idea, but we really don't know how these forms of stimulation actually affect the brain, particularly in the developing brain, which is undergoing amazing change. And so we know that the adolescent brain is incredibly neuroplastic, and we don't know whether these forms of home use brain stimulation might inadvertently affect the way that the brain develops in the future. So my advice would be, if people are considering something like this, to hold back until we know more about the long-term effects of these forms of brain stimulation.
I'm Jess McGaugh. I'm here at the Queensland Brain Institute with Dr. Claire Bradley, and I'm in test room 3. Today I am getting my brain zapped. Hi Claire, how are you today?
Very well.
So I'm looking at the machine here that's going to do the brain stimulation, and it's actually not very big. It's 30 centimetres in length and about 15 centimetres in width, and not very high off the table. It's actually quite unassuming. Claire, what is this machine that I'm looking at, and what kind of brain stimulation does it do?
So it's actually a TDCS machine, transcranial direct current stimulation. So it's actually very simple. It's pretty much a battery to which I'll connect some wires that are connected to electrodes that I'll place on your head. And that allows us to deliver a very small electrical current that we use to try and modulate your brain activity. Nothing dramatic. It's actually a very small current.
So I'm going to be perfectly safe.
Hopefully, yes.
Okay, so here we go. Claire's going to now attach two electrode pads. One is going to my right forehead and the other one is going to the top left-hand side of my head. Why are you placing that one there, Claire?
So it's just over your motor cortex, which is the part of your brain that controls your movements. And we'd like to try and modulate its activity while you learn some movements.
Excellent. Okay. So now that I'm all wired up and ready to go, we're going to press go. Wow. Okay. So it actually isn't painful at all. And all I can feel is a slight tingling, which is now gone. So not painful at all. That was great.
No, and that's quite the experience that a lot of people report. There's not much happening. Sometimes a bit of tingling, sometimes it stays for more or less long, but often it just disappears quite quickly and people want to know if anything's happening at all.
What other applications does this machine have? And are you still looking for anyone to be involved in your projects?
So this machine has been used to investigate some treatments, for example, for pain or for chronic depression in other countries. Currently at the Queensland Brain Institute, we use it to try and modulate both attention and learning. And we've got a trial looking at the effects on motor learning with possible eventual rehabilitation purposes. And we're looking for people over 65 to take part. So if you're over 65 and keen to participate, we'd love to hear from you.
Tell us in more detail about this study that you're currently leading.
So what we do know is that neuroplasticity is a process that occurs or is important throughout our lives. But as we age, neuroplasticity mechanisms become less effective. And my research is trying to work out ways that we can boost neuroplasticity in the aged brain. And one way we think that this can occur is by mimicking some of the aspects of sleep that we know are really important in helping to strengthen neuroplasticity in the aged brain. The other problem, I suppose, with aging is that as we age, we sleep less, and that can affect how our brains function. So what we're trying to do is to mimic some of the aspects of sleep that we know are important in consolidating these plastic changes. And we're particularly interested in a component of sleep known as non-REM sleep or slow wave sleep. That's that really deep sleep that you fall into straight after you fall asleep. And it's characterized by really high amplitude, low frequency oscillations in brain activity. Turns out we can actually mimic those aspects of sleep by applying an alternating current to the brain at that same frequency, and it seems to have the same effect as if someone's sleeping. And it can help consolidate some of those plastic changes that we're inducing. So my research is actually trying to harness those aspects of sleep in the aged brain and seeing whether people can learn more effectively.
That's incredible. So talk me through what a study participant would do when they come in. It seems quite invasive and intensive, this stimulation, but actually it's not really the case necessarily.
In fact, we've got a couple of experiments going on, but one of them involves participants coming in and learning a new task. So they're just basically trying to match a couple of visual stimuli that they'll see on a computer screen with some keyboard presses. So a very simple task, I suppose. And the brain stimulation that we apply there is this oscillating electrical brain stimulation. It turns out that if they receive that form of brain stimulation, most people can't actually feel that brain stimulation when the machine's turned on. So it works really well in that respect, that people don't know whether they're receiving the brain stimulation or not. So people come in, learn the task. We put an electrical cap on their head, which we refer to as an EEG cap.
So they're awake the whole time this is happening?
They're awake the whole time this is happening. And that's, I guess, the unique part of our experiment, is that we're trying to induce sleep-like brain rhythms whilst the participant's still awake. So I guess sort of tricking the brain into thinking it's asleep, harnessing those effects whilst the brain's still awake.
You've mentioned the link between brain stimulation and neuroplasticity. There's also a link there between decreased neuroplasticity and some diseases of brain function like Alzheimer's disease. Can you tell us about the link there between using these devices to stimulate the brain and potentially offsetting the development of these diseases in the future?
Sure. So we know that there's emerging evidence to suggest that as people age, their ability to undergo neuroplastic change reduces. But we also know that people who are older tend to sleep less effectively. And there's a strong link now between impaired sleep patterns, cognitive decline and potentially the development of these forms of degenerative brain conditions such as Alzheimer's disease. So the research that we're currently looking at is recruiting a group of participants who have been diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment. Now, this is a condition characterised by impairments in memory, and unfortunately, people diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment are at a higher risk of developing Alzheimer's disease down the track. So what we're trying to do is to recruit these participants, get them to learn some cognitive tasks, but at the same time we're applying these brain oscillations with brain stimulation to try to improve those brain rhythms in the awake brain. Because we know that one aspect of sleep that's important in cognitive decline is that it seems to flush out some of those neurotoxins that develop during the day that might eventually lead to Alzheimer's disease. So if we can flush them out, I suppose, artificially with brain stimulation, down the track, it might help them to not develop Alzheimer's disease.
So the potential applications of brain stimulation are really far-ranging and exciting.
The applications of brain stimulation are seemingly endless. They can be used in a variety of things. So there's a lot of research undertaken to look at depression, a variety of movement disorders, improving function in normally functioning people as well. Basically, every time that I open up a journal article, there's another application of brain stimulation out there.
Looking to the future, are there any ethical concerns that brain stimulation could give people an unfair advantage? Is there even evidence to suggest that this sort of brain stimulation does improve cognitive performance in a tangible way?
So I think that's been referred to as brain doping in the literature, and it would be nice to think, I suppose, that it could boost cognitive performance in normal functioning individuals. I suppose the problem is that the brain seems to want to get to this normal amount of function. So in the disease state, whether it's working too well or not well enough, the brain seems quite good at getting back to a normal state. There's not a lot of evidence to suggest that people whose brains are functioning normally respond as well to these forms of brain stimulation. So I don't think that there's a lot of scope for people to, I guess, artificially boost or turbocharge their brain's ability to learn new skills or to perform tasks more than what you might get from training alone.
5 or 10 or 20 years down the track, what do you envisage the common usages of brain stimulation to be?
Well, I think it's going to evolve in the clinical domain quite a lot. So it's already been approved in the US to treat depression. And I think not too many years' time, it's probably going to be approved as well for stroke recovery. So those conditions where brain activity is either underactive or overactive, and we know the basic underlying mechanisms of how those conditions have affected brain function. We also now know more about how brain stimulation can interact with brain activity. So where those two components fit in quite well, I think that the use of brain stimulation will be quite commonplace in clinics around the world. For those people that are listening to the podcast and they're interested in this research, particularly the elderly participants, we've got a couple of studies underway for participants aged over the age of 65 who are healthy, normally functioning. We'd really like to hear from you if you're interested in participating in these experiments, because we really need those participants to try to understand more the link between brain plasticity, sleep, and brain oscillation. So if you're interested in participating, please contact me and I'd be grateful to hear from you.
That was Dr. Martin Sale speaking about brain stimulation. If you'd like to find out more about his clinical studies, go to the QBI website, qbi.uq.edu.au, and click on the Get Involved tab. That's all for this episode. I'm Donna Liu. Our podcast is produced by Jessica McGaugh. If you enjoyed this episode, let us know on Twitter or Facebook, tell your friends, or give us a review on iTunes. We'll be taking a break over the holiday period, and we'll catch you in the new year. Happy holidays, and thanks for listening.